in amazement at how God puts up with the heart of the wicked person, the wicked heart of human beings. And it just stands as, how? When you see the depth of our wickedness, how do you continue to extend your grace to us? And I want us to think about that. I want us just to think about God's grace. And just how much wickedness he will endure and continue to extend his grace to people. And then I also want us to consider if there's a limit. Because I think in this chapter, these chapters 18 through 20 in Genesis, the limit is found. There is a limit. So I want to look at a couple of things. And it's these ideas. Five inexcusable responses to God's grace, mercy, and power. Five inexcusable responses to God's grace, mercy, and power. The grace, mercy, and power go together. Because sometimes his grace is actually a demonstration of his power. So when people see a demonstration of God's power, they need to understand, it may not be because God is smiling on you and he just thinks you're great and he wants to show off his power to you and give you a special experience that he doesn't give other people. In fact, if you look at Scripture, many times the demonstration of God's power is done to people who are the most stubborn, the most unbelieving, the most wicked, the most have want nothing to do with God. Think about it. What stories? Let's begin. In the Bible, what places do we see God's power demonstrated the most, at least initially? Certainly in the Exodus. And who got to see that? Who got to see those 10 plagues? Well, Pharaoh. He didn't deserve it. The Egyptians, they didn't deserve it. But then we realize, well, Israel. How long did it take before we realized they didn't deserve it either? That generation of Israelites that saw all that power, they're called the unbelieving generation. So it's a mistake to think that God demonstrates his power. So if you've had some great demonstration of God's power in your life, let me help you out here. Don't jump to the conclusion that it's because God thinks you're great and you're special and he wants to give you something that he doesn't give the rest of his people. I'm not saying he can't do that, and I think he does. And he does do that for people in Scripture. But I am saying, most of the time, when he demonstrates his power, it's because he's extending grace to a heart that needs to be softened. He's extending grace to someone who is struggling with believing. And in his mercy and grace, he gives them a little taste of his power and his mercy so that they might be quickened, they might come alive to him. So there are five inexcusable responses to God's grace and mercy that we see in these chapters. Sarah's incredulous dismissal of God's promises. Sarah's incredulous dismissal of God's promises. Sodom's insatiable means it can't be satisfied. It's an unsatisfiable wickedness. Sodom's insatiable wickedness, but get this part, towards outsiders, because this is important. Lot's son-in-laws, inexplicable, you cannot explain this, guys, their hard-heartedness in this story. What they do, and they only have one line in the entire story, but when you read the story carefully, what they say in that one line is unexplainable. It makes no sense at all, except for their hearts are so hard, we can hardly imagine it. Lot's wife's presumptive ignoring of God's warnings. All of these things are acts of grace. All of these people are responding poorly to an act of grace that God has given them. And the one that really is the worst, Abraham's senseless insistence on trusting himself rather than God. It makes no sense at this point in the narrative. Let's take a look at them. Genesis 18, 9 through 15. They said to him, "Where is Sarah, your wife?" And he said, "She is in the tent." And the Lord said, "I will surely return to you about this time next year, and Sarah, your wife, shall have a son." And Sarah was listening at the tent door behind him. Now Abraham and Sarah were old, advanced in years. The way of women had ceased to be with Sarah. So Sarah laughed to herself, saying, "After I am worn out and my Lord is old, shall I have pleasure?" And the Lord said to Abraham, "Why did Sarah laugh and say, 'Shall I indeed bear a child now that I am old? Is anything too hard for the Lord?' At the appointed time, I will return to you about this time next year, and Sarah, you shall have a son." But Sarah denied it, saying, "I did not laugh," for she was afraid. And he said, "Oh no, you did laugh." I just want you to see a couple phrases that has nothing to do with the present point. It will have to do a lot with the last point. Your wife. Next time you read through Genesis 12 through 21, I want you to mark every single time God says to Abraham, "Your wife." It's unbelievable. There are passages when God is talking to him where he refers to Sarah as your wife 5 times in a row. Your wife, your wife, your wife, your wife. It's almost as if Abraham needs to be reminded that Sarah is actually his wife. By the way, that is an act of grace. An act of grace that Abraham kept ignoring. God will prompt us with the truth. He will prompt us that we're not acting rightly. And he will do it over and over and over again because he is a gracious God. But we need to hear it. Abraham could not hear those words. "Sarah, you know, Abraham, your wife, not your sister, your wife." It just never registered. Let's take a look at Sarah, though. I will say this, of the 5, I feel like Sarah probably should get the biggest break. But before we give her the biggest break, we need to see that from God's standpoint, she isn't deserving of a break. God extended grace to this woman, and she's not responding to it correctly. She has an incredulous dismissal of God's promises. Sarah is in disbelief, just from our passage that we read. Sarah laughed to herself because she did not believe the promise God had just stated. For the way of women had ceased to be with Sarah. She struggled with believing because it was impossible. You know, it reminds us that God didn't call us to believe just in the improbable. He called us to believe in the impossible. If we think about what is the essence of our faith, what should it be focused on? Well, at least a part of it needs to be focused on this. That God raised his son, Jesus Christ, from the dead. That's not improbable. That is impossible. But this too is impossible. God wants us to trust that he can raise us from our spiritual death into a life where we are responsive to him and obedient to his spirit. In other words, guys, living rightly, living righteously, listening and hearkening to the Spirit of God as he leads and guides and directs us is not something that's improbable. It's impossible. It cannot be done. And therefore, every Christian's faith needs to be in something. They need to recognize God can do the impossible. Interesting, this text tells us that that is exactly what God says. Don't you understand who I am? I'm the God who does impossible things. Sarah's disbelief stems from the fact that she thinks this is impossible. That's not her only problem, though. Sarah is dumbfounded. That's different than unbelief. She's dumbfounded about something. I think, let me say it this way before I give you the picture of it. I think it's like this. Lord, even if I could believe what you're saying, and I can't, why do it now? Why give me a child now? She's dumbfounded about something. After I am worn out and my Lord is old, shall I have pleasure? This isn't practical. It's not only impossible, it's impractical. You're going to give me a son now that I'm 90 and Abraham's 100? What kind of parents do you think we're going to be at this age? How are we going to raise a kid at this age? Even if I could believe you, Lord. She's struggling, not just with disbelief, but with, I can't see how this could work even if I could believe. And she's in denial. Sarah denied it, saying, I did not laugh, for she was afraid. I point here, it is pointless to deny that you laughed to someone who hears you laugh to yourself. Remember what the text said. She laughed to herself. She is the only one who knows she laughed. It wasn't out loud. It was to herself. And then this Lord that Abraham is talking to, and by the way, he's actually referring to him as Yahweh. He is actually using Yahweh's name. Sarah is listening. She knows who Abraham thinks it is. She knows this is the God of this is Abraham's God. This is the one that's made all the promises. So she's listening, and that one says to her, Sarah, why'd you laugh? You know, when you laugh to yourself and somebody says, why'd you laugh? It's pointless to deny it. He already knows your heart. He knows what you're thinking. This leads us to some things that we need to consider about Sarah and her incredulous response. It's not appropriate for Sarah to respond this way. You might say, well, let's give her a break. She's 90 years old. Wouldn't you have some doubts, Tom, if you were a 90-year-old woman and God said you're going to have a child next year? Yeah, I probably would. But I'm not Sarah. And we need to remember some things about Sarah. Sarah is incredulous because Sarah has personally experienced the power of God in her own deliverance from Pharaoh and the curses God placed on his house. Remember what those curses were? None of the women could have children. Sarah knew what God could do when it comes to having or not having children. Now, I suppose we would say it's a greater miracle for Sarah to have a child than for several hundred women in Pharaoh's court not being able to have one. But both are pretty unlikely. Sarah was aware of that. But that's not all. She also had secondhand knowledge of the miraculous deliverance of Lot. No, she probably didn't go, but she saw how many men left with Abraham, 318. And she knew, she's from that part of the world. It's not like she doesn't know where Elam is or Babylon is. Earth sits right between those two cities. She knows the size of these kingdoms. She knows the size of these armies. And she just sent her husband off with 318 men to chase them down and attack them and bring back Abraham's nephew Lot. And he comes back victorious. She knows what God can do. There's not an excuse here. It's not like she hasn't seen God already do the impossible. Besides, Sarah has a front row seat on the blessings of God being poured out on Abraham. She has been with him the last 25 years while she has watched after Abraham came home that day and said, hey, some God knocked on my door. I've never met him before. But he wants to go show us a land. And he says, if we'll go, he's going to do these things. And one of them, he's going to bless us. He's going to give us all kinds of stuff. Sarah knows this. And over the last 25 years, she's watched this husband of hers. Everything he touches turns to gold. Every time he turns around, he's acquiring more possessions, more people, more livestock, more this. At some point after 25 years, especially, you know, maybe if she had just married him, she might have thought, it's Abraham. He's such a brilliant businessman. But she didn't. They were 75 years old. He was 75 years old. They had been married for, 20, 30 years? She's quite aware of Abraham's abilities. He didn't have this kind of success the first 65 year or 60 years she was with him. He didn't have that. She knew him all the way. Actually, she grew up with him, so she would have known him since she was, you know, first could remember him. He wasn't successful back then. She's watched over the last 25 years, everything he touches seems to be blessed. And anyone who comes into his life, they seem to be blessed, just as God had said to him. Because Sarah had a firsthand knowledge of God's revelation to Abraham and Hagar, both of them. And Abraham's extraordinary acts of faith as a result of that revelation. Sarah was often listening. She was listening. She certainly heard the revelation that God gave to Abraham just a few weeks prior to this, that she would have a child in a year's time. Abraham was so confident in that revelation that all of the men in his household got circumcised. Now, that's an act of faith. That's confidence, at least it seems like it on the surface. And Sarah saw the confidence that these people were willing to put in God's promise there. She has seen Abraham do remarkable things, including going after Lot, because of the faith that he had in his God. Now, I put an asterisk here, and it's why I give Sarah a break. She's also seen the stupid things that Abraham has done, the unbelieving things that Abraham has done, the things that say this man has no faith whatsoever. And for that reason, we have to give her a little bit of a break. Because though at times she would see Abraham trusting in his God and trusting in these promises, there were other times, like every time he called her his sister, which, by the way, was all of the time. He didn't seem to have much faith at all. So why should she? That's Sarah. Genesis 19. But before they lay down, the men of the city, before they laid down, it's talking about the two angels that came to Sodom and Gomorrah. The men of the city, the men of Sodom, both young and old, all the people to the last man, surrounded the house. And they called to Lot, "Where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may know them." And Lot went out to the men at the entrance, shut the door after him, and said, "I beg you, my brothers, do not act so wickedly." But they said, "Stand back." And they said, "This fellow came to sojourn, and he has become the judge. Now we will deal worse with you than with them." Then they pressed hard against the man Lot and drew near to break down the door. Sodom is a perplexing place. Sodom's insatiable wickedness toward outsiders. I asked my class on a take-home question just to see how they would answer this. I asked them this question: why did God destroy Sodom and Gomorrah? So I ask you, why did God destroy Sodom and Gomorrah? Maybe to be more specific, what exactly is their insatiable wickedness that led God to destroy them? One student wrote, "I'm not comfortable answering this question." And I wrote, "That's probably because you got it wrong." If you knew the right answer, you wouldn't be so uncomfortable with it. However, if you understood the right answer, you'd be even more uncomfortable with it, because you would know it may be your problem as well. What is the reason God destroyed Sodom and Gomorrah? We think we know. God actually tells us exactly why he did it. It's just not in Genesis. It's in Ezekiel chapter 16. "Behold, this was the guilt of your sister Sodom. She and her daughters had pride, excess of food, and prosperous ease, but did not aid the poor and the needy. They were haughty and did an abomination before me, so I removed them when I saw it." Now, I do think that the abomination he's referring to there is probably their insistence on taking these two strangers to their town and raping them. I do think that's what he's referring to, but you need to understand the context. It's not because they're homosexuals, guys. They're not. One person said, answered another question, the reason why they didn't want Lot's daughters is because the whole town were homosexuals. I said, I don't think you understand what's going on here. What's going on here is this group of people are trying to instill absolute fear in anyone that comes anywhere near them. Why? Because God has made them prosperous. God has given them wealth. God has made things easy for them. And they had no interest whatsoever sharing it with anyone. Think about it, guys. Why did God destroy Sodom and Gomorrah? Because he blessed the socks off of them. And he did it because he wanted them to bless people. And what did they do? They did everything they could to bring harm to people. And they went to such an extent that they would commit such an abomination merely to instill fear in their neighbors and the people that travel through that area so that they would not in any way come near their stuff. I could say it this way. God judged them because that is a horrible response to his grace in blessing them. That's a scary thought. I think God has blessed us. I think he's blessed our country. I think he's blessed our country 100 times beyond whatever he did for Sodom and Gomorrah. And I think we better be careful if we create the idea that our job is to make sure nobody else gets our blessings. That we treat the sojourner, the alien, the person outside of us, that we treat them in such a way that, you know, we'll be civil, but we're going to guard our stuff. That's what Sodom and Gomorrah did. And that's what got them destroyed. Now, I don't think we have reached the place of the abomination Sodom and Gomorrah did in terms of protecting our stuff. But we may be heading in that direction if we're not careful. Sodom, their insatiable wickedness towards outsiders. Sodom forgets who Lot is to them. This fellow came to sojourn, and he's become the judge. They have forgotten who Lot is. Let me tell you who Lot is to them. Lot's the reason why you guys are alive. Lot is the reason why some of you are alive, and some of you are not living in Babylon and in Elam. So if you want to complain about the guy, just remember where you would be if it wasn't for him. Because if it wasn't for Lot, they would have never been rescued from Chedorlaomer and his army. And they would have been hauled off into captivity and would have been slaves in a foreign land. Let's remember what you owe Lot, Sodom. Sodom forgets who Lot is to Abraham. Now we will deal worse with you than with them. Do you not remember what Abraham did to 4 kingdoms, 20 times his size, who took his nephew? Merely took him captive. Do you not know what Abraham did to them? And what Abraham's God did to them? And you think you're going to get away with killing Lot and Abraham not responding? You might want to just stop and think about that. You might want to pause and just put it on pause and say, you know, guys, if we kill this guy, his uncle is not that far away. We saw what happened the last time somebody tried to do something to Lot. It really got his hackles up. Are you sure we want to do that? Sodom forgets who Lot is to Abraham's God. This is really what got them in trouble. The men of Sodom, both young and old, all the people to the last man, surrounded the house. I beg you, my brothers. Could go 2 ways with this. Most of the time, I think the evangelical church goes the wrong way. They don't go the way of Peter. They think Lot calls them his brothers because Lot has bought into their way of life. He has been sucked into the sins of Sodom. But we know from 1 Peter or 2 Peter chapter 2, that is not true. In fact, it is the opposite. Lot anguishes in his soul because of the wickedness of Sodom. Now you have to put a couple things together here to make sense of this. If Lot was only anguishing about their wickedness, there's an easy solution. What is it? Leave. Just leave, Lot. I'm sure Abraham would welcome you home. Come on. In fact, Lot had the opportunity to do that, a great opportunity to do that. Once Abraham rescued him, brought him back, and he meets with Melchizedek there outside of the valley there where it sits below Jerusalem, Salem at the time. I mean, hasn't this question ever crossed your mind? Why did Lot go back? Why did he go back to Sodom and Gomorrah? I think many Christians for years have answered that, oh, because he just loved the life in Sodom. He just loved the city life. He loved that nightlife of Sodom. Really? 1 Peter says he hated it. And then he anguished over it. So why does Lot not leave it? Because Lot was not just anguishing over their wickedness. Lot was anguishing over the people of Sodom. In other words, what broke Lot's heart was not that they did wicked things, but that these people were being destroyed by the wicked things they were doing. There's a difference. He's not just anguishing over wicked things. He's anguishing over people who are destroying their lives doing wicked things. What in the world is Lot doing down in Sodom? I think he tells us. God sent him there. And I think I can make a really strong case for it throughout all of these chapters. God has sent him there. Because God knew he was going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. And even as the Lord says to Abraham, and we know this from the Tower of Babel, God does not destroy some place because of their sin until he gives them a witness of who he is. And Lot is that witness. And Lot says, I beg you, my brothers. He has identified himself with them, not in their wickedness, but in their humanity. And he begs them. He is God's voice to them. Stop this wickedness before God has to do something about it. Look at the grace. And I can see I'm not going to make it through the sermon, but the good news is it's an easy one to stop. We're only going to get through probably these guys. We'll have to look at the last three next week. But I want you to see just how much grace God poured out on Sodom before he was willing to destroy it. It's ridiculous. And maybe it will help you. Maybe it will help you realize, wow, God is one reluctant judge. He is one reluctant judge. Look at them all. When did God reveal himself to Sodom and Gomorrah and extend his grace to him? Number one, when God made them prosperous. Why was Sodom and Gomorrah prosperous? Oh, because they were on the trade route. Oh, because they were just well-positioned, smart people. They knew how to do business. Baloney. They were prosperous because God made them prosperous. God extended, and by the way, were they wicked then? Yes, they were, because all the way back in chapter 12, when they're first introduced, they're introduced as, you know, that wicked place. They were wicked, and God made them prosperous. I am sure some of their more righteous neighbors were writing books about, why does God allow the wicked to prosper? They hadn't read Habakkuk yet. Well, here's the reason. Because the wicked need the grace of God. How can you expect the wicked to respond to the grace of God if they've never experienced it? So in their wickedness, God extends grace to them and they prosper. When Lot first pitched his tent toward them. Lot gets the bad deal in that chapter. Everybody in my entire class pointed out, nope, we think what he did is a bad thing. He took the best of the land. Read it more carefully. He did not. He took the land down in the valleys. By the way, Abraham never went down into the valleys. Why? Because that's where danger was. That's where the cities were. Abraham always stuck to the hill country. He didn't want the land down in the valleys. He wanted the hill country land, and Lot gave it to him. But the real thing that you see in that text is Lot didn't really want the land down there in the Jordan. He didn't even stop there. He kept going right across the Jordan and right towards Sodom and Gomorrah, right out of the promised land. In other words, I don't think it was Lot that was directing him. Oh, I know he looked up and he saw that the land was like the garden of God. I know that. But I think that's what God was letting him see, because God was guiding and directing him. And what was God guiding him, directing him to? Well, first of all, to get him out of the promised land, because he wasn't going to be the heir. I'm going to get you away from Abraham and out of the promised land that I'm giving him. I'll give you something else. But Lot, I got a different job for you. I want you to go to Sodom and Gomorrah, because I can see how things are going. And they need to know me. And Lot, you're the man. You're the man to reveal me to them. I want you to go down there. I want you to intercede for them. You will see how wicked they are, because you have my heart, Lot. You will anguish over their wickedness like I anguish. They need to see that anguish. They need to see it in you, because they need to know that I'm anguishing over their wickedness just like you are. Lot going to Sodom and Gomorrah was God's grace towards them. And it doesn't stop. When God, through Abraham, rescued them from their certain destruction, when they were taken captive, when these cities were destroyed, they deserved it. But God saved them anyway. And interestingly, we know that the only reason why God saved them was Abraham went and rescued Lot. One of them deserved to be saved. And his name was Lot. And because God saved that one, and they had some kind of relationship with that one, they all got saved. Who does that sound like? You guys know, because I've preached 4 sermons on Lot, just on Sodom and Gomorrah. Lot is the very, very best type of Christ in the Old Testament. He is a perfect picture of him. Because their salvation came because of their association with him. They deserved to perish. Lot deserved to be saved. Abraham saved Lot. God, through Abraham, saved Lot. They were just collateral salvation. That's all they were. You've heard of collateral damage? They're collateral salvation. And that's all we are. We're collateral salvation. God saved his son and raised him from the dead. And if we put our faith in him, we are associated with him. We become incorporated into him, and we get his salvation. We get his righteousness. This is grace. And let me tell you, come on, when you were reading the story and you got to this point, chapter 14, surely, if the first time you read it, you would have thought, I bet those Sodom and Gomorrah people change now. I bet they start. Some complete stranger came and saved us because another complete stranger happened to take up residence with us. Surely they will change how they treat complete strangers. But they don't. When God, through Abraham, returned not only their people, but also their possessions. They knew that in war, the plunder goes to the victor, and they were not the victor. They had no claim on any of their possessions once Abraham had retrieved them. But Abraham said, you will not say you made me rich. You take them. You take your possessions. God, in other words, made them prosperous again. Come on, God. How long are you going to do this with these people? We already can see they deserve to perish. Can't you see it? When Lot returned to Sodom and Gomorrah after Abraham's rescue, Lot, I'm not done with you. I know you want to stay with Abraham, but I'm not done. They haven't changed yet. I want you to go back with them. I want you to take up residence with them again. I want you to continue to anguish over their wickedness. I want you to continue to show them my heart. Maybe they'll change. When God sent his angelic messengers to them, he could have just said, enough's enough. Lot, get out of town. He knocked on Abraham's door. He could have knocked on Lot's door without sending messengers. He could have knocked on his door and says, get out of town. I'm wiping these guys out. I've had it with them. No, he sends 2 messengers down there to see if the outcry is true, to see how they will treat these strangers. Well, we saw how they treated them because of their insatiable wickedness. How about when he blinded them? Honestly, here's where you start seeing just how hard-hearted they are in the next 2 things. Guys, he blinded them at the door. Wouldn't that be enough to make you think, I might be on the wrong path here. I might be taking the wrong course. I think I need to go a different direction. This Lot guy
I don't know who his God is, but I think I'm going to start worshiping that God. They personally experienced the supernatural power of God blinding them. And do you know what they did? They spent the entire night groping for that door. Groping for a door in their blindness. They didn't go, "What am I doing?" They didn't fall on their knees and cry out to Lot, "Lot, intercede for us, save us." They spent the whole night groping for the door. That's how they responded to God's grace. When Lot warned the city of their soon demise, we are told that next Lot gets up in the morning and he goes into the city, finds his son-in-laws, but I think there are other people. He warns them over and over and over again. Get out. Remember, guys, every last one of those men were blind the night before. And he says, you know those two guys that made you blind? They said they're going to wipe the city out and you need to get out of here. And none of them listened because their hearts were hard. And God is not done when God allowed Lot to hesitate. Why do you think Lot hesitated? I think there's two answers, and one relates to his wife. But I think one answer is the same reason why God hesitates. You know, it's Peter that tells us that God is waiting as long as he possibly can before he brings his judgment for every last person to come to him. And I think that's why Lot is hesitating too, because he has the heart of God. And he hesitates hoping that just one, maybe two, maybe someone, maybe my wife will be willing to come with me. He's waiting on someone to leave with him. And finally, the angels just grab him by the hands and say, time's up, and they take him out. And I didn't even have time for number 10. And then there's Zor. God's grace, even after his judgment, keeps flowing. When God says, when Lot says to him, because it's, by the way, I think Lot is showing the heart of God here. This is not Lot being a lazy guy who, you know, sometimes we describe him as a procrastinator. And therefore, God had to, okay, I'll give in, I'll save Zor. That's not what's going on. Lot is illustrating to us God's heart and how hesitant he is. And even so much that even in the midst of how deserving this place is of total destruction, we see the heart of God in Lot when Lot says, I don't think I can get that far. Could you just allow us to get to this little town? It's just a little town. And if you let us stay there, you're only going to be saving a few of these wicked people. And God says, I can do that. Because Lot, your heart is my heart. And as much as these people deserve to be destroyed, I want to give one act of grace left. I've got one more act of grace. I'm going to save a small number of them from this certain destruction to let them know that my heart was not to destroy them, but was to save them. Guys, that's grace. And then God destroyed them because they would not respond. How much grace has God extended to us, and how are we responding to it? I sometimes think God has extended far more grace to each one of us in this room, more than he did to Sodom and Gomorrah. It seems like his grace gets extended to us on a minute-by-minute basis. How are we responding to it? Maybe the better question is, if our greatest desire is to be conformed into the image of Jesus, how much do we look like Lot? Do we have his heart? Do we look at the wicked people around us and do we anguish? Not because we have to endure their wickedness. Do we anguish because their wickedness is destroying them? Can't you see what you're doing to your children? Can't you see what that decision is going to do to them? What it's doing to you? Can't you see that you won't have the joy of a family that comes together
and enjoys one another in celebratory seasons. Because you're making these decisions that just bring destruction to you. You're going to cheat on your wife. For what? For a little moment of pleasure. And look at the destruction it causes you. Look at how much pain you're going to experience for the next 50 years. Look at the pain you're going to cause these people that you love so much. Do you anguish over that? I think Lot would. If Lot lived in our world, he'd be anguishing over that. Not the wickedness, but what the wickedness was doing to them. And that is really the message I think we should take from this text is, Lot's not the problem. Lot was God's answer. And we need his heart. Instead of praying, oh Lord, come smash him quickly. Just come and let him have it. Get rid of all those liberals. Maybe we should be hesitating. Oh Lord, hesitate. Please give us some more time. Give us some more opportunity to pray. Give us some more opportunity to show them your heart. Give us more opportunity to reflect who you are to them, that they may come to know you. Wait for the very last moment before you shut that ark's door, that the very last one might come in. Let's pray. Lord, we ask that the heart of Lot, since it so clearly reflects your heart, will be a